Group meeting, Saturday, 22nd May, 1982.
Those of you who have studied the teachings of the Buddha and practiced them seriously will remember how often the Buddha talks of the peril of the senses. And we all know that in the religious teachings throughout the ages, we have always been warned about the senses. Beware of the senses. They deceive you and they drag you down and so forth. Now, I think it's a bit of a pity that it is only the troublesome aspect of our senses and sense functioning which has been emphasized so much in all the great religious disciplines of the world. And in so many instances, it has led to unnecessary and harmful repression and misery. Now, I think it is more than high time that we had a more whole, a complete overall view of the senses, their functioning, and their part they play in our lives. And if one really studies religious teachings very carefully, one will see that religious living and yoga and any similar practice and discipline necessitates the use of all our senses fully and rightly. Now, note carefully, I say use, not indulgence. Because it is the indulgence of our senses which lies at the root of our difficulties with religious living. We must learn to allow the senses to function freely. Now I say we must learn to allow them to function freely because right from infancy onwards and later on, and especially later on in school and university and in the world of doing things, we are so conditioned that we use our senses and let the senses function in a restricted way only. Now, this restriction is necessary where, say, scientific work or engineering or some mechanical material skill or know-how is concerned. In a laboratory, for instance, in a science laboratory, it is not possible to let every child who has begun to study science to use his senses freely. He is told what to look for in the course of his experiment, what he is trying to discover, what he is trying to prove. Otherwise, there'd never be any progress in science if everyone has to start off anew. We have to sort of start off taking for granted that which our predecessors have discovered was true. This applies to the scientific and the material sphere very, very strongly. You see? And the same applies also to general behavior. There is a certain amount of conditioning which is unavoidable in any case and which is by no means harmful. It is beneficial because it saves us a lot of unnecessary trouble finding out for ourselves what is really our ordinary heritage as such. So apart from that, we have to learn to let the senses function freely. Because otherwise, in all situations, we will be inefficiently observant. And we will not really progress. And above all, the mind will suffer from fixed ideas, mental fixations of all sorts. These fixations of the mind, or the psyche if you like to use that word, these fixations are like tumors in the psyche, and they prevent us from flowering out as human beings. One of the difficulties in this connection, of course, is that we are always presented with a picture of what we ought to be, and what we ought to do, and how we ought to behave, and so forth. It is not English to do so, or it is not Argentinian to do so, or whatever it is, you see. These are foolish fixations. There may be, and frequently there is, a certain amount of truth in it, because the general beliefs and modes of conduct of a society are the result of experience, an experience which has taught that society what is inclined to be beneficial for society rather than harmful for society. But only thus far is that permissible, so to say. Otherwise, we have to keep our minds completely open. And this is extremely difficult, to keep the mind completely open, because our consciousness is all the time inhibited by the activity of the brain, which is full of various ideas already to start with. Right from childhood, the brain is being stocked up with certain ideas. So now, take for instance the use of eyesight. If it is a question of using our eyesight for scientific purposes, then of course we have to train our the use of our eyes to observe in the right way, so that we don't waste time going over ground which has already been covered. But where ordinary life is concerned, and what is immediately happening all around us, merely to train our eyesight makes us see what we are expected to see or supposed to see. But if we are inhibited that way, we won't see more than what we are expected to see or compelled to see. And it means regress for us rather than progress. It is only by letting our sense of sight be used freely and on the alert for the new that there is progress. Otherwise there isn't. Now it's the same with our sense of hearing too. Take for instance the way we are conditioned to hear music. We are told by our music teacher, listen for this, that, and the other, which are the points which distinguish that particular musical composition or so. So we tend to listen for just this, that, or the other. And because we are not paying full attention immediately now as the music is progressing, we miss out a great deal of the subtle beauty which is involved in the structure of Western music, certainly. You see, I mean, I discovered that from my own experience. And I had listened from the time that I came to England in 1921, listened to all the great orchestras, all the best pianists and singers and violinists in the world, and quartets and so on. And I had been told by those who taught me in my school days, listen for this, listen for that, you see. Well, I listened for this and that and certainly heard it. And then the trouble arose, the first trouble which arose was this. Comparison crept in. Oh, he didn't play it like so-and-so played it and all the rest of it. Now, if that happens, I miss the beauty and the perfection which that particular exponent had to present through his performance. And gradually I learned to listen openly for the 101th time or the 1001th time to the same thing, with a completely open mind, not looking for the thing which I wanted to hear or was expected to hear. And then it was a very different story altogether. There was no, you see, if you're conditioned to hear in a particular way and you don't hear it, you are disappointed with it. And you say, oh, it was a waste of my time coming here, and it wasn't like so and so, it wasn't what it ought to have been. But if you listen completely openly, you will enjoy it through and through, every time. And you will hear new beauties. And there'll be a different kind of response from your own psyche to it. So now, it is very important to let our senses function freely, openly, and avoid the inhibiting effect of various conditioning, so much conditioning. Now, let's inquire, whence does the indulgence of our senses derive? And particularly, for instance, our sense of taste. Because this is one of the best examples. Surely the indulgence of our senses comes from our greed for sensational delight. When we are children, for instance, of course it's perfectly natural, as we say, unquestionably it is natural. I like this and I want more of it, and I eat and eat and eat this, you see, till I am sick. And so there we are. So this indulgence of the senses derives from greed, fundamentally, for the sensational pleasure of the thing. And and by indulging it, it makes us slaves of our pleasure drive. And this we apply in every sphere. If we have a liking for what we commonly call cultural pursuits, we indulge in that inordinately. You know how people, for instance, will turn on the radio all day long, and so ultimately they've come to a state where indiscriminately they are having all this come at them all the time, and really dulling their senses rather than cultivating their senses. So whether it be in the material realm of food and drink and tobacco or whatever it is, or whether it be in the cultural sphere, this giving in to the passion for the sensational delight harms our senses, our sense functioning. And of course it leads to pain, to disappointment, to illness of body and psyche, and sometimes to sorrow. Now, right use is rooted in intelligence. One has to see clearly for oneself what constitutes the right use of our senses. Indulgence, of course, is rooted in ignorance, in folly, in weakness of character, and lack of self-knowledge. All these factors play their part. If we pay complete attention to the present actuality, here now, what is actually present, then full use of the senses takes place naturally and spontaneously. In paying full attention, there of course we deliberately have to direct our attention to what is actually present. And then our senses will be used fully and rightly. So, what happens is that whereas indulgence results in self-centered action, the right use of the senses is selfless action. Because in paying attention to whatever is conveyed to us through the senses, a relationship is formed between oneself and that to which we are paying attention. A relationship is formed. Now what spoils that relationship? First and foremost, of course, imperfect observation. An imperfect observation is due mainly to the fact that we have been conditioned to use our senses this way or that way, instead of letting the sense function freely and healthily on its own. Imperfect observation implies, of course, the lack of full attentiveness. Our attention, our mind, as we say, mind wanders. And although one may be looking at what one is supposed to be looking at, one doesn't take in what is taking place in front of us. Then there is wrong interpretation by the brain. And this obviously is the result of all our conditioning from infancy onwards. This wrong interpretation by the brain is one of the outstanding obstructions to spiritual progress. Because we think we have got hold of the truth or the right way of living when we certainly are nowhere near it. Look at the way fixed ideas, fixed doctrines and dogmas are hopelessly misinterpreted. There is a profound meaning to all the teachings which exist, but they are hopelessly misinterpreted, and generally they are misinterpreted in a material way. You know, for instance, doctrines like Immaculate Conception and Virgin Birth. These are doctrines which exist in all the religions of the world, with regard to Zarathustra, with regard to Sri Krishna, with regard to so many of the teachers. Several of the teachers, everyone ascribes Immaculate Conception and Virgin Birth to them, you see. Now what does that mean, really? Conception, the word conception has two meanings. One is the ordinary biological meaning of conception, as a result of which a child is born, you see. The other meaning is conceiving in the mind. Now look at the relationship there. The biological conception results, if everything goes well, in the birth of a living being, a living creature. You see? And conception in the mental sense also, if it is a true conception, means results in the emergence of an idea, a profound perception, which is a living force in our lives all the time. A living force in our lives. This is the relationship between the two uses of the word conception. Now, a living force in our lives implies, therefore, that it will promote our spiritual life, if the conception is a true conception. What do people do with regard to the commoner garden doctrine of Immaculate Conception and Virgin Birth? They take it literally. Well, there's no such thing as an Immaculate Conception literally. Parthenogenesis, they say, has occurred in the human race, but the evidence is questionable and it is very, very doubtful. You see, parthenogenesis means the birth of a child without sexual relations, without any marital relations. As I say, we can discount that. Now, when a person is really pure in his whole psychophysical being, then he is an apparatus for the reception of seminal ideas of truth in his reality. He can see truly, and in that seeing truly there is an immaculate conception. And in that immaculate conception has, within the mind, within the whole mind, has an influence upon his whole consciousness. His whole consciousness undergoes a complete transformation. And this complete transformation results in that person being converted into an instrument for divinity itself. The Son of God, as we call it, in the Western world, the Brahmaputra, as we say in India, you see. This is the power, this is the thing that happens. It is the purity of the individual, and I emphasize the purity because the purity of the individual implies that the conception which emerges is absolutely free of any concupiscence, is the result of any sort of concupiscence. There is no emotional or intellectual desire, possessive desire underlying that I would like to see, I want to see the truth, and so forth, you see. Because of that, the whole life urge is completely pure. And then this immaculate conception takes place in the mind, which releases the Son of God, as we would say, into actual manifestation. Now that, to me, is the deep meaning of teachings like that. But look what has happened in the world. In the Christian world particularly, the idea of the resurrection and the ascension are hopelessly misconceived. And yet St. Paul, writing in Corinthians, First Corinthians, gives a very clear explanation of the whole thing when he says, "What is sown in corruption after death rises pure," the gist of it is, it rises in spirit, utterly pure. There is no rising after the death of the existential being. After the death of the body, everything that is associated with the material body dies completely and utterly. The mind, what we call the mind, the feelings, the thoughts, the ideas, and discriminative consciousness itself is completely gone. The I am I consciousness is completely gone forever and ever. So the somewhat natural passion people have for getting a reward in a mythical hereafter is a foolish passion, born of ignorance. There is nothing for me. Again and again I have said that. Absolutely nothing for me. What there is for me is here and now, so to live that this organism becomes a fit vessel for the manifestation of the totality in terms of man, what the word man stands for, the happy creator, the creative thinker, the sort of thought that is implied in the phrase, the thought in the mind of God. That is all that can happen through us. We individuals are like the clothes which God wears. After a time, you know, the clothes are worn out, and what does he do with the clothes? They are discarded completely and utterly. Maybe they are burnt up, or they become floor cloths, or whatever it is, and there comes the time when the dust cart takes them away. And that's that. Now we cling to these clothes, and by clinging to the clothes and wanting something for ourselves, a reward in heaven or in hell if we want to be very, very warm, you see, we want a reward for ourselves and an attainment and an achievement of nirvana or the kingdom of heaven for ourselves, which is a complete absurdity. Nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, and so on are the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. How can I slice out a bit of the infinite for myself? It cannot be done. Try and slice a slab of space and screw your nameplate upon it and say, my space. It just can't be done. You see? Let's be content with the fact as the fact, the absolute fact. This is the perishable, the infinite and the eternal by self-constriction. Don't ask me how the infinite and eternal, the transcendent, constricts itself. I don't know. And even if I knew, even if I could be in my innermost consciousness, be conscious of what happens there, it would be impossible to put it in language and in ordinary concepts. Quite impossible. You see? That can't be told. But that's the mystery you can experience in consciousness, by becoming utterly pure. This is the great thing. So you see, wrong interpretation by the brain. The brain, of course, is limited to the manifested world and the phenomena of the manifested world. It cannot penetrate into the transcendent world as brain. Because brain all the time produces mental constructs, it produces verbal patterns and so forth, which represent that which is finite and perishing all the time, not the imperishable. But if the brain becomes quiet and one is in a state of real inward peace in the mind, then this profounder faculty of the mind, which is dormant in all of us as we are, which is dormant, sleeping, awakes, and you can be conscious of that which cannot be put into words. But you can be conscious of it. That's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? But that is the marvel and the mystery of our human existence, and how wonderful that is. But we must let go this clinging to a self, a separate self. As I put in that article, Sophia, if you or I, as separate selves, could enter nirvana, we would only stain the white radiance of eternity. For the simple reason that we would introduce an obstructive separate factor into that which is whole, holy, complete, total, immeasurable, infinite, and so on. So you see, these doctrines and dogmas hide profound things, but we have to be able to penetrate into them. And we cannot penetrate into them by mere brain work, but by the complete purity of the whole of the psyche and the body. The body need not always be entirely healthy, but if it is sufficiently healthy, it will work, you see. With the complete purity of the psyche, we can penetrate into these things, and then our whole life, our lifestyle, gets transformed. And there is peace and inward joy all the time. Then the brain plays its proper part in our life. It is our servant then, and not our master. The brain, after all, contains only the known, that which is already known. The brain doesn't contain the new. The brain is the necessary material apparatus through which the totality of mind can function freely. And when we are utterly pure and free of our preconceptions, prejudices, biases, assumptions, and all the faults of our desire nature, our mental defilements, as the Buddha called them, you see, then things go right with us. And then the brain can produce most illuminating ideas, which, as ideas, can affect our society and the world for centuries for good. But we must not cling to the ideas. There comes the time when their efficiency is worn out. Their effectiveness is worn out because life has gone ahead during the centuries, during the millennia. And so they must be discarded. You see? So many profound truths in the great scriptures of the world are still operative because we haven't moved far forward sufficiently. Look at our world today, what a state it is in. And we pride ourselves on our civilization and progress and whatnot. You see? Now, when we use our senses attentively, in the early stages, there will always arise a reaction. You see something, or you hear something, or smell something, taste something, or touch something, and a reaction arises out of one in reply to that sense impression. Now, in the early stages, they are mere reactions, and generally speaking, they are reactions which are a hindrance to our inner growth and fruition. Because of our conditioning, the obstructive force is all our conditioning up to the present moment. That is the obstructive force. But if we observe that reaction carefully, particularly the reaction of with the brain talking back at the sense observation, say you see somebody, you're looking out of the window, and you see somebody kicking a dog or or being nasty to a child or something like that, you see. As I have seen, as I used to see so often in the very early days when we were here, schoolboys picking out bottles of beer out of the lorry. They used to wait here, and the drivers used to go to the restaurant opposite to have a little tea or whatever they wanted to have, and these little rascals would just climb through the back of the lorry, pick out the bottles, put them in their buckets, and then leg it. You see? And of course I know what my reactions were. Very mere reactions. I thought half a dozen of the best would be the best thing for them. Probably it would have been for their stage of development or lack of development. But there we are, you see, mere reaction. There's no point in having the mere reaction, for the simple reason that it only arouses hate or misery or disappointment or anxiety or fear or all that which defiles the mind, defiles the psyche. So we must beware of that mere reaction. And the thing is not to suppress the reaction. Never suppress it. Watch it very, very carefully, because that is our heaven-sent teacher at the moment. The reaction which comes up by itself like that. That reaction is very important. Very important as a teacher. And as we really see the true nature of that reaction, the purification of the psyche proceeds. Because where the psyche is concerned, I've said this so often, the diagnosis, the examination, the diagnosis, and the medicine are one and the same thing. See? Well, when it is not a reaction, mere reaction, when we are past that stage, then we are capable of a true response. Now, what does this imply? We have already considered this point about the relationship which exists between us and whatever is the source of the impressions which come to us through our senses. You see? Now, the true response means that in our actual observing, we observe with complete understanding of what is happening and compassion at the same time. Understanding not merely in the ordinary intellectual sense of the whys and the wherefores, the analytical sense, but that understanding which makes a living link between that which is being observed and ourselves, the observers. There's a living link created. And in that living link, there is compassion and wisdom involved. And there's an extraordinary beauty in going through that sort of experience. It really is wonderful. One is then a focus point for order in the universe, in the whole universe. We think that, oh, what am I, just one little thing? Well, of course I am less than the dust, if you like. Less than a grain of dust, a speck of dust. But this speck of dust can affect the entire universe with transformed consciousness. When consciousness is transformed, it affects the totality. We don't know that. The human race is quite ignorant of that fact. But when you or I can undergo any real transformation of consciousness, then all the world is affected for good, straight away, without our knowing it. And it's a force which acts. If the brain is not quiet and chatters, then we put ourselves in the position of the subject, the observing subject, versus, against the observed object. But if it is a true response, then we are not against what we observe, but we are with it in the true sense. In that sense, where the power of transcendent love and compassion and wisdom all operate together. And that is the energy which brings order and beauty into the whole universe, the whole world. So, our observation then becomes harmonious, it becomes holistic, whole-making. And thus there is no mere reaction, but a response which emerges from the heart, from one's own heart, which is whole, sane, and holy. The brain is never sane. The heart can be sane. You see? Now, there is a tremendous implication in all this. The tranquility of the senses and the brain enables the mind, and there is no such thing as my mind. Mind is a universal thing, a universal energy. It enables this universal energy to function freely through your brain or my brain. And when it functions freely, then all that flows from us is essentially right and healing. It has healing power in it. You may even experience things like true clairvoyance and clairaudience. Now beware in this direction, because people deceive themselves right, left and center because of their natural egoism and vanity, you see. In my lifetime, I've come across so many people who suffered from this kind of egoism. Oh, they were sensitives, they were clairvoyants, they were in touch with this, that and the other supernatural spirits and all that tommy rot and nonsense, you see. And they were just deceiving themselves all the time. So whilst we are bodily alive, this sensitivity, and note the word sensitivity, which is related to senses, this sensitivity to transcendence, the energy of transcendence, and its action through us comes to fulfillment, and one becomes a focus point for the truly worthwhile in the world, not only for oneself but for one's whole society. And oneself realizes here and now the Unio Mystica. Here and now. One has to be very careful not to deceive oneself that, on such and such a day I had an experience. All right, you may have had an experience, but an experience belongs to the realm of the finite and the mortal. It is not the immortal. When the true Unio Mystica takes place, it never leaves you. It is there permanently. Now, in India, some people do know that as an intellectual statement, an intellectual fact. And they lack the integrity to prevent their rather adulatory, foolish followers from saying that, this person is God incarnate and he's all the time in tune with the infinite and all that stuff. If anybody claims anything for himself or introduces material considerations into the situation, shut the door. But otherwise, there is the way to the true fulfillment of being human.